So, we should be praying for Syria. You don't always hear about what's going on in Syria, but it's absolutely horrific. This country is one of the most stable countries in the Middle East, with the second largest number of Christians, percentage of Christians in the Middle East. And before the war, it looked like a paradise. Now it's in many parts like a wasteland. And some of you have seen this picture before, sent to me by friends in the Middle East, Christians in the Syrian army in church, because many of the Syrian Christians are in the army. Much of the army are Christians because they know the only thing standing between them and being beheaded or worse by the ISIS and al-Nusra terrorists is the army of Bashar al-Assad. And therefore, you could see a lot of the soldiers, I mean, here's damaged, desecrated churches, Orthodox-type churches. This is a Flemish, that means a Belgian minister, Daniel Maas. He's been witness to the war, and he says the idea that a popular uprising took place against President Assad is completely false. The Americans and the Allies wanted to completely ruin the country. You do not know that the media coverage on Syria is the biggest media lie of our time. Do you think the Syrian people are stupid? Do you think these people are forced to cheer for Assad and Putin? And so you see pictures like this of Christian leaders embracing Assad, visits to churches by President Assad and his wife, missions, and this, you know, this is meant to be a hideous dictator, but there's no ring of protection between him and these people. And in the middle of the Christian churches, he always joins them for Easter and Christmas in particular. And, you know, here the churches, again, where's the security? But he actually moves amongst the people. This you often find. He has leaders of all different types of religions, and including many churches, present with Assad. Popular expressions of support. We should be praying for Syria. The New World Order wants to destroy them for a whole lot of different reasons. National Alliance for Life, they recently had a conference up in Pretoria. And we had displays there, some friends of ours, but I think you can see Dr. Albu van Eerden in the background there, some of our literature tables, some literature for Africa materials, some of our friends up in the church at Pretoria. And this is part of the life chain that they organized afterwards. And good to know that the pro-life movement in Pretoria is going strong. Now, I should give you some feedback on a mission team in Sudan. The Nuba Mountains has been a place we've been ministering in for 23 years. It's been a major, important part of our work, an island of Christianity in a sea of Islam. So, four of our missionaries are there right now, quite desolate-looking area. This is part of the largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled into a Muslim country. 40,000 Bibles, 50,000 other Christian books. Story of Jesus, and you can see here some of the, you know, bomb craters and destruction of buildings, and you can see they've really been bombed and battered, and the shrapnel in the roofs, and Aubrey busy pumping the water. Now this is a well-made well point, because all too often I see these NGOs come and they just put a well there and there's mud all around it. But for a bit of extra money to build a concrete bin and lip, very helpful, so that the animals who come don't have to drink out of the mud, but they've got some fresh water not draining into the ground, but in a trough that runs from it. That's the way we always insisted to make wells, and I kept telling people, don't allow people to build a well without building a concrete rim and a place so that we don't waste the water that inevitably gets spilled, because the animals have to drink too. So that's the team. Hunter, Aubrey, Ben, John. And they are averaging something like 13 schools a day, assemblies and meetings, distributing the Bibles. I heard from Tarrant today that they have distributed already 27,000 Bibles. That's mind-boggling, because it took me a year to distribute 10,000. And that was on long missions. I think I did that year, 5 missions to Sudan, and we struggled to distribute 10,000. But they're doing it different from us. They're going to schools, and they've arranged with the schools, even Muslim schools, to take Christian books and Bibles as textbooks for them to learn English. And our friends Samaritan's Purse were providing transport, but of course transport does break down, and then you're off to walking. Notice how the women are carrying the boxes and the men aren't carrying anything. That is typical Sudan. Sorry? Yes, there was one man there, and I thought congratulations to him, indeed. But unfortunately, a lot of the other men are just carrying like a book or a notebook or cell phone or something. This is the way school assemblies often take place. People gather in a big hollow square, and you've got to find something to stand on to give a bit of elevation and to communicate to them. Some of the books being handed to the schools, and here are Bibles. Here they're holding up the Jesus story, the story of Jesus books being distributed. And that gives you a bit of an idea about the terrain and the vegetation in the mountains. It's hot, it's arid, it's in the 1040 window, it's the southernmost point of the Sahara Desert. It's quite a rough area. And an island of Christianity in a sea of Islam. These people have been fighting for their lives for over 70 years against the Islamic government. So it's an extraordinary operation. And this looks like a school and maybe one of the school textbooks. And now they've got the Bible. That's going to be the main school textbook. So the story of Jesus, 50,000 of those taken in as well. And more of the schools this route. So that's just give you a bit of a feel. We'll be posting more on the Frontline Fellowship website as the information comes in. And we're looking forward to, in just over a week's time, the team being back, God willing, and giving us report backs. Just a reminder that our Salt and Light radio program on Monday nights is now 9:30 p.m. They've moved it from the 10 slot back to 9:30. I think they had complaints. And we just had interview with Jonathan Sucker this last week on Literature for Africa Ministry. And it's, of course, based out. Anthony Stunder gets a week, Carl Free, Shaw, Van Veek, and Aubrey. They take turns. And on every Tuesday night, I'm giving a From the Frontline podcast that's available on our website. Of course, our aim is clear. Complete and utter destruction of communism, secular humanism, radical Islam, New World Order. And to this end, we are planning an open day 2 weeks from now, a journey exploring 500 years of South African history, Christian history, and we've got the author of Bulala, Kuan Elgin, coming as a guest speaker, and his wife, Belinda, as an artist. Belinda and Marina will work on arts and crafts with the children, aided by Emma and all the other volunteers from the mission who have no choice, they are volunteered. And so there's going to be a full-on children's program with arts and crafts, and Kuan and I will take turns in the boardroom here giving presentations on South African history. So it's a concentrated, from 9 till 4 in the afternoon, South African history emphasis day. Obviously, you can't exhaust South African history in that time, but we guarantee it'll be politically incorrect, not what the secular humanist ANC schools are teaching. It'll be the rest of the story, the uncensored version of our history, which is absolutely critical. While it's primarily for home educators and their children, anyone else is welcome to join as well. So, you'll see I put on the table some tracts, leaflets, booklets, and posters to help advertise the open day, and it's, of course, on our website. So this week, as part of our Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism, we're wanting to look at how the New World Order is hijacking civilization, not something you can expect to see as a theme on CNN, the Clinton News Network, or BBC, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, or Slime Magazine, or Useless News and World Report, or the Cape Crimes. The media is not going to be giving this story. So that's what we want to do. We want to look at what's not normally being told. The New World Order has used wars and economic depressions and recessions and population control, especially Bill Gates, who is advocating vaccinations to bring the world's population down to under a billion. He's been saying the world's overpopulated, and if we could get rid of 6 billion surplus people, the world's going to be so much better. And so if you think vaccinations are there in order to extend your life expectancy and make you healthier, you're missing the whole point. It's all part of population control. to bring about the globalist agenda. Now, how are they doing that? Demographic engineering, through aggressive population control tactics, promoting birth control, abortion and sterilizations, and massive propaganda of overpopulation. The globalists aim to drastically bring down the population of Europeans and Americans. Now just look at how effective they've been. 1960, 2010. This is the marriage rates in European countries. Just look at the plummet. They're all plummeting. Some have come up a little bit and then down, down, down. But basically, the marriage rates in Europe are going through the floor, plummeting down, 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 down. And whereas before the First World War, the average woman in Europe was having 6 to 8 children. Now they're having 1.2, maybe, most likely having an abortion and adopting a dog. But before the First World War, 64% of people in Europe were in church, on average, 64% every Sunday. Before the Second World War, it was down to 42%. After the Second World War, it was down to 4%. And the collapse of marriage in Europe and the collapse of birth rates in Europe have gone along with the collapse of church attendance. Here you can see the population changes. Notice they take it from 91, but just see just about everyone's going down. About the only ones going up is the Slovak Republic here, interestingly. And you can also see that there's also Poland. Poland's not doing bad as well. Poland's actually going up. So there's very few countries in Europe having an increase in population. Europe's population change, look what they're advocating and estimating. From now till 2050, they're estimating decreases of from 20% in Poland down to 33% decrease in Ukraine and so on. But there's going to be increases in some parts in Western Europe. Why? 377,000 African migrants every year until 2015. 1.2 million Asian immigrants, another word for Muslim, coming every year until 2015. Their goal is population replacement. Bring down the population, those people traditionally Christian, raise the percentage of those who are more manipulable by the New World Order. Now, these are just 30 countries. The top 30 countries with the greatest projected population increase and decrease between 2100. So, you can see the green are population increases. I mean, some of them are going to be absolutely phenomenal. And they reckon the population increase is, that's percentage. Niger, Zambia, some of the greatest increases. But notice Europe, China, absolutely plummeting, plummeting, plummeting. These are just 30 of the most radical. The 30 greatest increases, the 30 greatest decreases, and it's quite staggering to see how population demographic suicide and demographic replacement is part of the New World Order's goals. Notice this is a United Nations document, 2015. Then by betraying stable governments in Africa, Asia and South America and bring about economic collapse. I mean, just think, for example, country I was raised in, Rhodesia. Stable as anything. Who would want to leave Rhodesia? I mean, nobody starved in Rhodesia. Yes, we had droughts and so on, but nobody starved. Not even animals starved. I mean, they were organized, ready. Water was stable. Electricity was stable. The moment the war was over, sanctions ended, economic foreign aid poured in, suddenly the country totally collapses. And half of the population of Zimbabwe flee. And they don't have power failures in Zimbabwe. They occasionally have electricity. Power failures is normal. You know, here you might have a power failure. There they occasionally get electricity. When the government's got an announcement they want to make on TV and the power comes on. The vast movement of refugee populations has been stimulated into Europe, North America, South Africa and Australia. This is Limpopo border, nearby bridge, Zimbabweans exiting without a visa coming into this country. Half of the total population of Zimbabwe have voted with their feet, a vote of no confidence in Mugabe's ZANU government, and fleeing. And then by dramatically decreasing populations of those countries traditionally Christian, I mean Europe used to be known as Christendom, Just take a United States stat. These are all the wars America's been involved in. Civil War through to Afghanistan. That's there. That's sliver. The red is the deaths from abortion. You think America's lost a lot of people to the Vietnam War and Afghanistan, Iraq and so on. Nothing compared to how many they've killed through abortion. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, the most merciful thing that a large family does to one of its members is to kill it. And President Obama said, "We are truly grateful to you. Thank you, Planned Parenthood. God bless you." How can God bless a bunch of baby-killing pagans? And then exploding the populations of mostly pagan and anti-Christian races, the goal is a dramatic change in demographics and the death of the West. That's the name of a book published by Patrick Buchanan some years ago, The Death of the West. And he's speaking demographics. Demographics, sterilizations, abortions, euthanasia, population control, all the way along, and the homosexual agenda, discouraging marriage, all the rest of it, pornography, all of that, and then population replacement with a whole lot of mega-fertile Muslims pouring in to take over and destroy Christian countries. Not an accident. This isn't just something that just randomly happened. This is planned. This is organized. This is a concerted effort. And notice the police having to climb up. I mean, you know, whatever happened to, you don't obey orders, you get shot. Rubber bullets, anything, but no. Here these people are, please come down, they're coming with ladders. I mean, really? Is this necessary? Is this even effective? If the photographer could get this picture, then why are the border control people not here? And yes, in they come. And they're not afraid of the police either. This, would you believe it, is Germany. And yep, that is cultural enrichment. You need diversity and cultural enrichment. And yep, but Merkel, who's probably done more damage to Germany than anybody since the Second World War, has a selfie with some Muslim immigrant who gets a higher standard of living unemployed in Germany than they would have employed in their country of origin. Your children will worship Allah or they will be killed. That's what it says on an Autobahn bridge in Germany. The sharp decline of the birth rate of Europeans and the massive influx of Muslim immigrants into Europe is hoped to bring about a transformation of Europe to Eurabia. They're talking about it. I didn't coin the term. Our enemies are talking about Europe becoming Eurabia. America becoming Ameristan. London becoming Londinistan. It's not a joke. English people are now a minority in London. The goal of all this is a world population more amenable and manipulatable for control by the globalists for the New World Order. Now, why must they get rid of WASPs? White Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Because give me liberty or give me death. No taxation without representation. My conscience has kept the word of God. These WASPs have been a pain in the neck of every tyrant out there. Because they think for themselves. They argue. They read the Bible. They stand up and they will fight. They will die. They will be burned at the stake rather than give up their views. Now, we're not talking about all them, but an irritatingly large minority of them have been a pain in the neck of tyrants through the ages. You know, you can mention them all the way through, from the Martin Luthers and Husses and Wycliffes all the way through. They have been the thorn in the side of the tyrants. And so to get a bunch of people who you can keep starved, you can, I mean, just take, for example, South Africa, where the ANC can lie, steal, loot the country, and the people will vote for them five times in succession, even after they've completely destroyed and looted everything, and everyone's life is much worse off, and everyone's life is much more dangerous, and your life expectancy is plummeting down, and they've turned the schools and the hospitals, which used to be the envy of the world, world class, where we led the world in heart transplants and kidney transplants and C-sections and all this, to suddenly where they disaster area, you wouldn't want to go near them. democracy is the system that picks Barabbas over Jesus. It's been like that for a long time. 50% plus one. You don't determine the truth by getting a show of hands. Truth is not determined by popularity. It's determined by the word of God. And so the idea that democracy is going to solve our problems is actually beyond stupidity, because look what they did to France. 1789, French Revolution. And of course, you can go back 2,000 years, and when the people were given a choice, they chose Barabbas. Democracy is the means by which those who adore authority and crave the security of servitude can use their superior numbers to enslave those who wish to be free. Democrats, a bunch of rich people convincing poor people to vote for rich people by telling the poor people that other rich people are the reason they're poor. You think it's just the Americans? Here we've got a billionaire who just became president, and his first act in office was to raise taxes on the poor. Increasing VAT. I mean, really, he's a billionaire, and he doesn't need to increase taxes. He could slash taxes to 10% what they are now without in any way decreasing services, because most of our taxes get stolen by corruption by the government anyway. Even according to the EU, a full 25% of the total GDP of South Africa is stolen by the government by corruption. More than 25%. How much is that? Well, 4 trillion rand is the budget. Over 1 trillion, 1 trillion point 1 billion is stolen by the government through corruption a year, every single year. That, by the way, is something like 10 times more than all the foreign aid. So who needs foreign aid? All you've got to do is bring corruption down 10%. Well, imagine you could bring down corruption by 50%. What about if you could eradicate it altogether? Well, most of our taxes aren't going to anything good. Oh, and that's not talking about their elaborate, opulent salaries and fringe benefits, which is criminal enough as it is. I mean, I still remember when politicians had to have a real job. My teacher at school was a member of parliament because they didn't get paid enough. Back in the 70s, you had to have a real job if you want to run for parliament or be a mayor or town councillor. It was an honorary position of someone who's already successful. He's donating his time. It wasn't a way of getting rich. So when I was going to school and you ask people, what do you want to be when you grow up? I mean, in my school it was farmer, soldier, game ranger, farmer, soldier. Yeah, you might get one weirdo who wants to be a doctor or or a lawyer, but today it's... I mean, there was a time when it was astronauts and so on. Now it's rock star, athlete, rock star, politician, rock star, politician. You know, I mean, how many people want to do a real job? But why? Because all the money's now on being politics. Poly-many, ticks, blood-sucking parasites. Politics, many blood-sucking parasites. From America being a mostly Protestant country, a Christian nation of people from a European background, the promotion of population control methods to suppress the growth of white, traditionally Protestant Americans, and stimulating a huge influx of immigrants from third world nations, will soon bring America to a position where the demographics are radically altered, and it's not impossible to think of a Miristan as a possibility. So, how do you pull it off? Well, you can't pull off a great heist or any kind of crime or looting without a lot of distraction. And the biggest problem is the church. So to distract and neutralize the Christian church, false doctrines and heresies have been vigorously promoted. Pacifism has been promoted, and a rapture fever obsession with end times prophecies have greatly distracted many Christians. When I was converted, 1977, late great planet Earth, Satan is alive and well on planet Earth, there's a new world coming, terminal generation, like a thief in the night, distant thunder. I mean, those were the staples that we were being fed. And like, who cared about the future? Or I didn't think I'd ever have children or be married or be on Earth in 1980. I mean, the world wouldn't be around in 1980. We'd all been raptured. So the whole mentality that was around when I was converted, that's why I've got very few pictures or anything to show of the early, because why did you bother to keep it? You're not thinking of the next generation, because we're the terminal generation. My father-in-law says, oh, well, we were being shoved that in the 1940s as well. Yeah, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. people being distracted with the end's coming. And so it doesn't really matter if everything goes to hell in a handbasket. It's a fulfillment of prophecy. And you're going to get raptured anyway. Why rearrange deck chairs in a Titanic? Why hang up wallpaper in a burning building? The world's going down. And so this irresponsible teaching, which comes straight from the Jesuits of the Vatican, that they injected it in the church in order to distract Protestants, because Protestants were basically taking the world, and this pacifism and antinomianism and escapism, defeat and retreat, rapture fever, premillennial, pre-tribulation, rapture nonsense, this has distracted the church to allow entire generations of Christians to sit back and do nothing while their countries and their children's and grandchildren's futures are hijacked, and the schools and even the universities and theological colleges are hijacked by people who hate us and hate God. Antinomianism, the hostility to God's law, has gutted the church of the law of God. It's the law of the Lord that's perfect, that converts a soul. Defeatism and escapism have neutralized many churches. I used to believe in this rapture cult. I was infected with rapture fever. It sucked years out of my Christian life when I could have been doing something more productive, because I was distracted with the fact that the world's coming to an end. Fortunately, in 1982, when the planets lined up and the end didn't come and the rapture didn't occur, I said, I've cried wolf too long. I mean, there's 5 years of this rubbish. And I ditched it. And then I was able to go to theological college, study, get a family, plan for the future, and do something useful instead of this endless date setting. Then there's worldly music, age-segregated services, which is evolutionary, youth groups, which entertain rather than educate. These have further undermined the Christian resistance to the New World Order. And the church has been derailed. Discernment is plainly at a very low ebb in the average Western church. Sensationalism, materialism, idolatrous elevating of high-profile televangelists, fake healers, not really faith healers, fake healers have sidetracked many believers from filling the Great Commission. Otto Scott, a friend of ours on the left, and this creep here, claims to be a Reconstructionist in the order of, and look, some people get tattoos before they get converted. This chap got tattoos after he got converted, and you know, some people converted are embarrassed about the tattoos that they've got in their pagan days. And they'll wear long sleeve shirts. This chap poses, and this is his profile. He runs Christian Reconstructionist Radio or something like that. By the way, he hates us. And he's launched a whole campaign against me, this character, because I'm a racist, apparently. You know, people who live in Africa and spend their whole life helping black people are racist. People who sit in radio programs in America and feather on this and have never sacrificed anything for the gospel, they somehow are able to judge others. Not that he's a member of a church, because he's above that somehow. So he's not a member of a church, not under any accountability, but he can excommunicate people like me. Here you get Christians in Australia at a gay parade wearing I'm sorry shirts, saying I'm sorry to who? To the homosexual perverts and gender, transgender characters. I used to be a Bible-banging homophobe. Sorry. I'm sorry Christians have shunned you. Have Christians really shunned and abused homosexuals? I have a number of friends who used to be homosexuals. We've had people come into this mission that had come from a homosexual background. The last words in the Pink Agenda book are from a homosexual who got converted to Christ, who's a friend of the McCafferty's, and had his testimony in there. Are Christians anti? I mean, do we hate them? Well, as far as I can see, we've always been loving people from whatever background, whether it's drugs, alcoholism, perversion. I mean, the church has been in the business of taking people from whatever background and having them redeemed. And so, you know, we've been engaged in bringing some. I've sat down and I've had meals with cannibals, terrorists, all sorts of people from all kinds of backgrounds. But anyway, these people, instead of evangelizing these homosexuals, which would show love for them, they're saying, I'm sorry, entrenching in the homosexuals a sense of I'm a victim and Christians are to blame, which, is this going to bring them closer to Christ, or is this going to entrench their sense of victimhood and harden them in their resistance to Christianity. I mean, why would they even respect someone so stupid? Most Christians barely notice that secular humanists have hijacked the schools and have continued to send their children to what are effectively anti-Christian brainwashing institutions. Should we call them indoctrination gulags? And our theological cemeteries have not done even as well. They've generally been infiltrated by liberal theologians and those who hold to theistic evolution. This, by the way, I don't know how many people can recognize what this is. The first theological seminary in South Africa, Stellenbosch University, Kweek School, founded by John Murray, Andrew Murray's elder brother, because the theological seminaries in Holland were too apostate back in the 1850s. And so they started this in 1860, and here it grew out of the revival. This was a bastion of reformed, evangelistic, missionary-minded vision. Today, they're so apostate that when we had the Calvin 500 in the year 2009, they basically marked it by tearing everything Calvin stood for to pieces, promoting liberation theology. By the way, the dean of students at the theological seminary said, I think about that time, theology has nothing to do with God. Theology has everything to do with man. That's actually anthropology, study of man. Theology, study of God. The dean of the theological cemetery there says theology has got nothing to do about with God. Well, that sort of explains why the Dutch Reformed Church has gone in the direction it's gone. And the resulting undermining of biblical Christianity throughout many denominations is like a cancer working its way through what used to be a healthy body. You know what a cancer cell is? A cancer cell doesn't contribute to the health of the body. It breaks down the health of the body. It basically is killing the body because it's parasitic. And notice the middle letters of cancer is A and C. And the A and C is a cancer. They've done nothing for this country except ruin it, wreck it, pollute it, corrupt it, undermine it. They are a cancer. And people who can vote for a corrupt, incompetent, useless, self-serving, cancerous institution like the ANC, they shouldn't even be allowed to walk out without adult supervision, let alone be given the vote. I mean, can people be so stupid? To vote for them once, that's stupid. Vote for them twice, that's imbecilic. 5 times in a row, that's brain dead. The Reformation roots of Western civilization. History testifies how God has blessed and used the Christian nations to bless all the families of the nations of the earth. That's not popular to say. Right now, bashing Christianity and bashing the West is the national sport of all the universities. But let's say what needs to be said. The Protestant nations of Western Europe have a great Christian heritage. Despite violent opposition, Protestants emerged from the fires of persecution to change lives, to make history, to transform nations. Faithful believers contended for the faith. They preserved and translated God's word. They reformed the church, and they vigorously proclaimed the word of God to all nations. In the 19th century, they literally reached all nations. Christian civilization achieved the highest levels of productivity the world has ever seen. There's no close seconds. Christian nations led the world in innovation, scientific discoveries, medical advances. If you like the idea of having electricity and plumbing and anesthetics before an operation done in a germ-free environment in the hospital, you can thank the Protestant Reformation. It's a fruit of the gospel. The missionary outreaches, the works of mercy. When did you last see nurses praying before their shift like this in a hospital? I remember seeing this, but not lately. Protestants from Western Europe successfully campaigned to end the slave trade and to set the captives free. They laid foundations for justice through the rule of law. This is Justice Lifts the Nations in the Palace of Justice in Luzern in Switzerland. Lady Justice, notice in Europe, Lady Justice is not blindfolded like the American Lady Justice. No, Americans love the idea of justice being blindfolded. But in Europe, Lady Justice always has her eyes open. She's got the scales of justice, like the American ones do, and she's got the sword, but not just pointing upright. In America, the Lady Justice got the sword, point it this height and scale just another blindfolded. But here in Switzerland, the sword points down to an open book which says plainly in it, Holy Bible. And so the elders of the city are looking up to Lady Justice. The people who have their arguments, and the sheriff is standing with a sword to settle disputes. All the problems, all the conflicts, all the issues of the society are to be determined by justice. The scales of justice with the sword of justice pointed to the open Bible. That's a biblical concept of checks and balances too. Notice you've got separate houses. You know, you've got the upper house, you've got the lower house, you've got the lawmakers, you've got the justice. The idea of separating powers into executive, judicial, legislative, and decentralization, which Switzerland is the premier example of, all that comes from the scriptures. The legacy of faith and freedom through Christian Europe is unparalleled in the history of the world. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. All shall bow before him. A posterity shall serve him. It shall be recounted of the Lord to the next generation. They will come and declare his righteousness to a people who will yet be born that he has done this. The 19th century was the greatest century of missionary advance. It was a spectacular century, a century of astounding inventions and of spectacular advances in technology. At the beginning of the 19th century, in the year 1801, you could not travel faster than a horse could run. At the end of that century, not only was the steam engine and the steamships, but even aeroplanes were being invented. Not to mention telegraphs and cables being laid so you could instantly communicate across the Atlantic. Many countries experienced dramatic spiritual revivals. Christian missionaries won whole tribes and nations to Christ. In the remotest reach of the globe, even amongst the cannibals of the South Sea Islands. Christianity came to the beginning of the 20th century on a rising and apparently unstoppable tide. Christianity was gaining spectacular momentum as missionaries from Europe were evangelizing and discipling virtually every tribe and nation, including the Maori cannibals in New Zealand, Christmas Day 1814. Samuel Marsden being celebrated here in a New Zealand postage stamp. Well, today New Zealand has got a lesbian Marxist Prime Minister and a hostility to Christianity from the government that boggles the brain. They wouldn't be bringing out a stamp like that these days. But these are some of the achievements of Christian Europe in the 19th century. Baptizing here in the uttermost parts of the earth in New Zealand. Listen to me, you islands. Hear this, you distant nations. You are my servant, Israel. To restore the tribes of Jacob, I will make you a light for the Gentiles, so that you may bring salvation to the ends of the earth. And here, some of the ends of the earth. This is now Australia and Indonesia. Christian schools. Protestant faith has far outstripped the Catholic and Orthodox branches in missionary activity, virility, and initiative. The Protestant faith became the dominant faith of the most productive nations on earth, the most powerful nations on earth, the most prosperous nations on earth. In both the Northern Hemisphere, Germany, Holland, Britain, United States, America, Canada, and in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, the greatest nations on earth were Protestant. And this is what I got my doctorate on. The greatest century of missions, the 19th century missionary movement. Amidst irrepressible optimism, many were openly speaking of the beginning of the biblical millennium on earth. At the first World Missions Conference in Edinburgh, 1910, delegates were anticipating the completion of the Great Commission within their generation. No one in 1910, at the world's first missions conference, would have anticipated the wholesale abandonment of entire nations to communism, to false religions, like Islam, and to heathenism. Nor would anyone in Edinburgh in 1910 have predicted that the church would retreat from victory to such an extent they would be questioning the existence of the devil, the existence of hell, reinterpreting marriage to include what God in the Bible has described as a perversion and an abomination. The Christian era of bold missionary expansion came to an abrupt halt as the guns of August 1914 erupted. the great European countries, which had been the heartland of Christendom, which had been the source of most of world missionaries, devastated one another's economies and annihilated millions of one another's young people in what has to be recognized as the most tragic, senseless conflict in history. And the sinister banksters who pulled the strings behind the scenes and engineered the auto-genocide of Europe were the same ones who owned many of the companies that made the machine guns and the bombs and the shells. This is Coventry. And who owns this factory? Lord Nathan Rothschild, who also ran the Bank of England and who also was on the war cabinet. So he declares war. He authorizes borrowing money from the taxpayer to pay his companies for the weapons that are going to kill Christians. And all of this is Lord Nathan Rothschild's Coventry munitions factory. And this all destroyed the cream of Europe. And what you have in the columns is the number of men under arms in thousands. So that's 1.3 million in Russia, 834,000 in Germany. And then the circles represent the money in dollars, their peacetime military budgets. So you can see how much Russia had, how much Germany is spending, and how much Britain is spending, and so on. And that money was almost all going to Rothschilds, because Rothschilds ran the banks of Italy, Germany, Austria, France, Britain, and America. They were getting money from all sides. I care not what puppet is placed on the throne of England to rule the empire on which the sun never sets. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply. Lord Nathan Rothschild. There are numerous studies that have shown the role of the Freemason bankers and politicians like Lord Nathan Rothschild, whose goal was to bring down Christian civilization, as was publicly stated. Nothing could have stopped the positive onward march of Christianity worldwide except that Christians were persuaded to kill one another so enthusiastically and so efficiently in the First World War. I've counted 64 Hammonds in six cemeteries within 10 kilometres of Ypres alone. That's just a small portion of Belgium. And there's 150 British war cemeteries there. I've just been to the six largest ones. And the ones I count were just on the walls. The ones on the walls are the ones that they couldn't find the bodies of. It's the ones that they found some part of the body that buried them. Names on the walls are the people they couldn't find the bodies of, because 85% of people died in the First World War died from artillery. In many cases, they couldn't even find the bodies. When I went to the British and Commonwealth War Graves Commission to find out, they informed me that 480 Hammonds died in the First World War. That's just my family name. There were whole generations wiped out for what? Even more devastating than the actual numbers of people killed and crippled or severely injured was the damage to the spiritual life of Europe. Europe went from being a Christian continent to being a more and more secular one. And the secularization of Europe following the First World War and the breakdown of moral standards coincided with the great resurgence of revolutionary fervor. And you can see the big winner of the First World War was the Soviet Union. The communists took the largest nation, the largest Christian nation on earth, the Tsarist Russia, and turned this Orthodox country into an atheistic, the first atheistic state on earth. Now, notice, because of the German defeat of Russia, in their Brest-Litovsk Treaty of March 1918, they required independence for Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Belarus, Ukraine, and the Caucasian Mountains. In fact, German troops all the way through these areas, through to the Caucasus. And in fact, interesting that you're back to what the Germans won at the end of the First World War, independence for these countries that had been captives of the Russian Empire. Unfortunately, once the Allies had extracted from Germany disarmament with the Versailles Treaty, they handed all these areas of Ukraine and Belarus back to the Russians. And then these are new countries founded, Czechoslovakia, Hungary. Czechoslovakia never existed before in history and doesn't exist now either. They've split into Czechoslovakia. It's two separate countries now. Yugoslavia never existed before. That's a creation just to cripple the Austrian Empire. They gave Tyrol, which is Austria, German Austria, to Italy, and just to stop Austria having access to the sea, even though the Austrian Navy had saved Europe from Islamic invasion with the Battle of Lepanto in 1571 and so on. But people might often wonder, why in the Sound of Music is the Austrian a captain of the Navy? I mean, did Austria have a Navy? Yes, they did. They had a very advanced Navy, actually. They invented the screw that drove the ships instead of sails that were done before. So, Austria, which was a huge area, this whole area is Austria. Austria then became a very small country, despite being the Eastern Empire, the Österreich, which used to protect Europe from the Turks for centuries. And they crippled Austria and Germany at the end of the First World War and guaranteed a second. But all these countries that were created out of Versailles Treaty's imagination. And so Marxist communism, which filled the vacuum left by the collapse of the great Russian Empire, the German Empire, and the Austrian Empires, a vacuum will be filled. And by collapsing these great empires that had protected Europe from Islam and the Turks for centuries, the Russian Empire betrayed, Austrian Empire dismembered, German Empire crippled. And what filled the vacuum? Secular humanism, socialism, Marxism. If the 19th century is the greatest century of missionary advance, the 20th century has proved to be the worst century of persecution in history. More Christians have been martyred for their faith in the 20th century than all previous 19th centuries combined. The bloodiest century in history is the 20th century. Now, if you follow the evolutionary garbage of and social Darwinism taught in our schools and universities, you'd swear everything's getting better. And, wow, the 20th century's been great because we've now got freedoms we never had before. Actually, 20th century's been the worst century in terms of morals, family stability, in terms of everything. We are going backwards. And I know this because I was at the Cape Town 2010 Missions Conference, which is, although nobody mentioned it, I had to assume it was more than coincidence, that we were exactly 100 years off the Edinburgh Conference, which was the first World Missions Conference in history. But when I compared Edinburgh 1910 with Cape Town 2010, we've gone backwards on every single level. What they were celebrating in 1910, extinction of cannibalism, extinction of slavery, extinction of widow burning, and all these other things, and like the triumph of Christianity worldwide. By 2010, what are we dealing with? I mean, it's so heartrending. Don't even want to mention all the subjects. The resurgence of slavery, for example, they estimated in 1910 there were no slaves in the world. 2010, 27 million slaves in the world today. There's more people enslaved today than there were when William Wilberforce began his campaign to end slavery back in the 1780s. It's absolutely shocking. But also, religious freedom. We've never had a time in history when so many Christians have been persecuted for their faith. 400 million Christians today, in 67 countries of the world today, don't have the religious freedoms we take for granted. 400 million Christians are living under violent, vicious persecution by the state, in mostly communist and Muslim countries. The Chief Culprit, Communism, good book. Future of the Global Church, I was with Patrick Johnson when he launched this book, one of the finest books overlooking 2,000 years of church history, and I've built lectures based upon that overlooking 2,000 years of church history, and he projects into the future too. But just look at some of his charts. Notice in 1900, most of the Christian nations were in Europe. Now these are the top 20 Christian countries in the world. And so in 1910, you can see the pink represents European countries. The red is the Americas. So you can see, while the United States had more Christians than any other country, Russia, the second largest, Germany, third largest, France, UK, and so on. Notice by 1950, you've got the most Christian country in the world in terms of population. America, Germany, Brazil, Russia. You've still got mostly European. But look now, by the year 2000, Europe barely makes the grade. It's only Russia and Germany as are the only Christian countries in Europe mentioned in the top 10. 2050, Europeans won't even be in the top 10. That's what the First and Second World War has done. Destroyed Christianity in its heartland. The top 20 evangelical countries, 1900, notice, overwhelmingly European, with Germany number 3. Notice by 1960, Germany's down to number 7. Europe's not even on the list for the year 2000 for evangelicals. This is also from Patrick Johnson's Global Story of the Church. Notice the yellow represents numbers of Christians, or percentage of Christians, I should say. Here's the percentage. That's 100% of the world's population. So it goes from the year 1 through 100 all the way through to the year 2100. So notice how Christianity is on an exponential growth until about the 5th century when it starts to plateau. And you can see that Muhammad and the rise of Islam is more of a judgment on a backslidden apostate church that's forgotten what it's there for. They've stopped growing. They've stopped expanding. They're plateauing. And that's when Islam comes. Now, green represents the percentage of the world's population that's Muslim. See how it grows, grows, grows. Notice about the time of the Crusades, the church starts to grow, grow, grow. But then in comes the Black Death and the population goes down. Slow growth, but roughly around the time of the Reformation, you can see spike and then plateau. Then in the 1800s, phenomenal growth. This is the greatest century of missions that I've been talking about, the 19th century. But the world wars bring the population of Christians down, the percentage of Christians down. But who's the winner? Islam. Islam's percentage was low at the end of the 19th century, but now it's phenomenal. And this just gives you an idea of a snapshot of 2,000 years of church history and 14 centuries of Islamic history, percentage-wise. Missionary-sending countries. Notice how missionary-sending countries, South Africa was number 5 in the year 1900. Germany is number 3. 1960, Germany's down to number 8. Missionary-sending countries, UK and USA still up top. South Africa's down to number 10. Over here, you can see year 2000, South Africa is down to 12th largest missionary sending country on earth. Germany's number 8, UK's number 4. America's still number 1, but they'll be overtaken soon. The time is expected when India and Korea and China will be sending out more missionaries than Britain and South Africa and Germany. Looking back over the last 100 years, you can discern how secular humanists have systematically hijacked civilization, Christian civilization. How? 5 culture-carrying institutions. Marxists have targeted the 5 major culture-shaping, culture-transmitting institutions on earth. Educational institution, that's the thumb. News media. Entertainment industry. Religious institutions, political institutions. These are the 5 main areas that Marxists target for infiltration. And these are the 5 areas we should target for evangelism and discipleship. If we want to transform the culture, disciple the nations, fulfill the Great Commission, we have to be sending missionaries into the schools. We need teachers. We need Christians making good films, right? Like Franz Cronier and Kendrick Brothers. We need news media. We need a new Christian journalism. That's why Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism is targeting this particular area. Religious institutions, well, that's what Reformation is all about. And the political institutions will follow if you will get the education, entertainment, and news media. Then politics will follow. Marxist revolutionaries, secular humanists, atheists like Richard Dawkins, and evolutionists have so thoroughly infiltrated most of the universities of Europe and North America and South Africa that today God is not only banished from the curriculum, but Christianity and its contributions to civilization are marginalized, ignored, or vilified. That's what's going on in our textbooks now. The faith that invented the printing press, that pioneered universities, that built the libraries, that pioneered hospitals, the nursing profession, ended the slave trade, birthed every branch of science, is now vilified. The greatest book ever produced, the Bible, is string verboten under Hienom Standigheda, don't even think about it, not allowed in the university. Christ, the greatest person ever lived, can only be used as a swear word in the average university today. Even scientists advocating intelligent design are mercilessly hounded from institutes of higher learning, so forth. And if you haven't seen this film Expelled, strongly recommend it. Yes, Ben Stein is an agnostic Jew. He's not even a Christian. He's known as a comedian, but this is no joke, as he goes and he investigates and he finds some universities, they've literally fired some of the greatest, most accomplished scientists simply because they don't believe in Darwinian evolution. They believe in intelligent design. And the funniest part is when he actually gets Richard Dawkins in the studio and interviews him. So where do you think life came from? And you know what Richard Dawkins answers? Aliens. He doesn't believe in God, he believes in aliens. Well, of course, the question is, well, where did the aliens come from? Other aliens. And those aliens were probably other aliens. But at some point, you've got to say, well, where did they come from? He can't even be consistent with... You would have thought an evolutionist would have a scientific answer, and he comes up to some kind of Star Trek, Star Wars, aliens from outer space brought life to Earth. Instead of education, teaching people how to think, we now mostly have indoctrination telling students what to think. I had a history teacher in high school, Mr. Rhys Davies, who's a member of Parliament in Rhodesia, who used to berate us for regurgitating textbooks. He said, think outside the box. Don't regurgitate the textbook. Beware the victor's version. Governments lie. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. Don't just regurgitate textbooks. Think. Ask why. Now, I must admit, when I came to South Africa and I came to Parliament High School for my matric year, I got into trouble with that because I'd been taught in Rhodesia to always question and challenge a textbook. And I got into serious trouble because I discovered in South Africa you weren't meant to question the textbooks in the same way that we were encouraged to in Rhodesia. And for example, in matric, there was one question in the matric history exam. Discuss the causes of the Second World War. My arm was aching at the end of that. Because I wrote until the last pen's down, and I could have kept going for a long time afterwards. And I got a zero. Just I thought, that's not what you were taught in school textbooks. And I asked for a remark, and I got A+. And the difference? Well, one teacher saying, but that's not what's taught in textbook. And the other one said, well, you gave sources and dates and places, and you obviously understood and you thought about it. And although it's not the traditional view that we hold to, I quoted AJP Taylor and a whole lot of other authorities justifying that the Versailles Treaty caused the Second World War and all the rest of it. And I gave chapter and verse, and just shows you from zero to A+. That's like cheetah's acceleration rate. So, what are our schools like today? It's sort of like indoctrination gulags. I mean, really, blinkers, yep, I would say. It's like any creativity and imagination you've got is to be sucked out and beaten out. James Dobson is bringing up boys. He argues the fact that education institutions there are so anti-boy, so anti-male, that it doesn't take long for the boys to realize, hey, the system's rigged. There's no way I can ever win. And so they go into gangs and just totally opt out because the system's rigged. The whole system, girls will always excel in our present schooling system because sitting quietly in desk, behaving yourself, speaking in line, waiting, and so on, being patient, being polite, it's not the sort of thing little boys do naturally. And the whole, and so James Dobson, who's a child psychologist, particularly points out that the entire rigid indoctrination gulag system is so anti-male, and the system content now is so anti-male too, that the boys pretty quickly tune out. And about the only way they can find any release is in sport, because the education system's totally and utterly rigged. And it kills your imagination. That's why homeschooling is really a brilliant answer. And, you know, a child being fascinated by God's world is told, come away, really. I mean, you're not meant to ask why. You're not meant to reason why. Yours but to do and die. So, sometimes you get good things here with... what's this? Peanuts. I'm pro-choice. Can I choose to smoke? No, it's not good for you. Can I choose to have a large shutter? No, it's not good for you. Can I choose to own a gun? No, it's not safe for kids. Can I choose an incandescent bulb? No, it's not good for the planet. Can I choose low-cost coal? No, it's not good for the planet. Can I choose to honor God? No, that's offensive. So what can I choose? Abortion. That's not a joke. That's actually what they mean by pro-choice. You're not, they say they're pro-choice, but they're not pro-choice when it comes to whether I can own a firearm or whether I can do this, that. No, then you don't have a choice. What do you really have a choice on? Abortion. That's about it. So, stop the National Rifle Association. They're killing our kids. But I'm pro-choice. I have the right to kill my baby. This is what you've got. The liberals. Liberalism is a mental disease, actually. We've got a book that just came in with that title. Liberalism is a mental disease. Anti-Christian secular humanists have dominated the entertainment industry of the last century, subverting families and undermining morality at every turn, rearranging reality indeed. Particularly insidious has been the scope of This Is a True Story, or Based on a True Story, or Inspired by True Events. It's a more common one now. Rewriting of history, distortion of reality. This is like the names and the places are true, but the facts have been changed to protect the guilty and vilify the innocent. As Karl Marx declared, the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. Marx's disciples have been very, very busy, both through the educational institutions and the entertainment industry, rewriting history. The textbooks and the films today are only good for starting fires. I mean, they're absolutely beyond worthless. When people talk about education, I can't believe the ACDP talking about how the government needs to allocate more money for education. Why? It's not working. It's worthless. Why would you want more of it? It's like the person who wrote home from the army saying, all of the food we get is poison and we don't get enough. You know, I mean, it's either poison or it's not. But if it is poison, why would you want more? And this business of we need to put more money into schools, the schools are worthless. They're not doing anything good. They're producing a bunch of whoremongering, fornicating perverts who thieve and steal and lie and strike and burn and destroy and vote ANC. The news media has come to be so overwhelmingly dominated by secular humanist prejudice against Christianity. It's the corrupt and conquer principle. The secular humanist mass media has consistently ignored the relentless anti-Christian persecution by communist and Muslim governments. Do they ever talk about the anti-Christian genocide in Egypt, or the anti-Christian genocide in Syria by ISIS, or the anti-Christian genocide in Iraq? Since the Americans liberated them, of course. Through selective focus, distortion of reality, the mass media has effectively brainwashed generations of Christians to vote for those who hate Christian values and to idolize those who are intractable enemies of their faith. The amount of Christians who, when you ask them, what leaders, living or dead, do you most admire? Who are role models for you? And in survey after survey, I've found Christians saying the same secular humanist, anti-Christian pagans that are being promoted in the news media in Hollywood, because they don't think like a Christian. Maybe their heart belongs to Jesus, but their mind belongs to the world. Now, in Rome, sports were used to distract people from social problems of the decaying empire. Glad we've evolved past that now. They used to have sports, you know, what's it? Bread and circuses. And now? What's McDonald's and circuses. Tolerance and apathy are the last virtues of a dying society. So about the only sin now in society is being intolerant. Well, they can be intolerant, but you're not allowed to question or disagree with them. You know, then that's about it. Corrupt and conquer, confuse, divide and conquer. Most of the mainline denominations, or should we call them abominations, have now been infiltrated by secular humanists called liberal theologians. What's a liberal theologian? Someone who doesn't believe the Bible. But you can't get a job in a church calling yourself an unbeliever. So they call themselves liberal theologians, or liberation theologians. Why do they even want to be in a church? Well, church got a lot of real estate and a lot of money in the bank and a lot of influence and prestige. And so basically they're hijacking church. These are people who are not even believers. They shouldn't have been let in the front door. And yet they are now running our theological cemeteries. They're running denominations, they turn them into abominations, and they are starting to promote everything from gender confusion to perversions that they now call marriage, and you can have unrepentant homosexual perverts as ministers. Where's it going to end? Well, the whole point is they're hijacking the church. And you may say, well, what's the benefit for them? Well, they've got a platform, plus they get to desecrate Christianity, but also they get to sell a lot of real estate. And so, for example, in England, they have sold tens of thousands of beautiful stone churches with stained glass windows, and you can go to England and find beautiful churches and chapels, which are now Hindu temples, mosques, restaurants, clothing stores, all sorts of things. And that money goes to keep the World Council of Churches, the British Council of Churches, National Council of Churches, South African Council of Churches, and so on, afloat, so that they can continue to have conferences promoting perversion and communism. And Christians put up with this and tolerate it and support them. And Christians put money in the offering plate of churches that are in the hands of wolves. Well, that's an insult to the wolves. No wolf deserves to be vilified by being compared with these liberation theologians. They've gutted the churches of the biblical gospel and produced generations of spineless evangelifish, filleted of spine. Many churches are now filled with pseudo-saved, semi-saved, half-saved, unsaved pew-warmers who've never been truly converted, nor have they come to any real relationship with our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Now, how do you get away with this? Well, you call anyone who disagrees with you a racist. Racist is a word you won't find in our dictionaries that we've got, like the 1828 Dictionary of Webster's and so on. It's a word made up by Leon Trotsky, the leader of the Red Army in the Soviet Union. In 1927, he produced this word to use it to browbeat any dissident of communist ideology. If you opposed communism in the Soviet Union, you were a racist. And this word has been very effective since. Just think how effective it is in South Africa. There are a lot of people who prefer to be raped or stabbed than called a racist. Unbelievable. They don't mind if their grandchildren's future is sold down a river as long as you don't call me a racist. As a result of the successful infiltration by secular humanists of education institutions, the entertainment industry, the news media, the religious institutions, and control over political institutions has been inevitable. I mean, once you've got education, entertainment, news media, religious and political institutions fall into your lap. Those who argue for the good of their nations are shouted down and vilified as dangers to society. Do you know, right now in Britain, there are scores of people in prison for Facebook posts, for opinions, for what we would have called freedom of thought, freedom of conscience. I remember when I was converted, Baptist saying, we may not agree with the Jehovah's Witnesses, well, we certainly didn't agree with them, but we would fight for the right for the Jehovah's Witnesses to have the same religious freedom we did. And that was a Baptist principle, that even if you disagree, even if you call them a cult and a sect, nobody's got the right to interfere with their religious freedom. Because if they don't have religious freedom, neither will you just now. So fight for all religious freedom equally. And we all used to think freedom of conscience and freedom of thought was a good thing. Today, you go to jail. In Germany, 50,000 people, including scientists, lawyers, historians, are in prison because they don't agree with the official verdict of what the government says is what you should believe, and therefore they are thought criminals. When George Orwell wrote 1984, it seemed far-fetched. I mean, this was a book I studied at school. Today, it looks like a manual they're working off. Thought crimes, thought police, vaporizing people to becoming unpersons and so on. Most nations now seem to be governed by political parties determined to commit national suicide and sell the nation's sovereignty to internationalists, literally. And we're seeing a kickback right now because there's people like Britain just voting Brexit. They don't want to be a province of Brussels controlled EU. And you can see Austria's going that way, and you can see Netherlands and Norway's already broken away, and we don't want anything to do with the EU. And so you can see there's a real move going on in Europe. Hungary is particularly strong on this, and Poland as well. No, we're not going to take Muslims in, even though the EU says you must, and so on. So right now there's a revolt. The peasants are revolting. The EU globalists are angry. Nothing is more dangerous than atheists playing God. They say they don't believe in God, but they make themselves God. The hostility of the United Nations to everything Christian should be obvious, but a consistent support for nations which persecute the church and their failure to effectively address the targeting of Christian minorities. The disgraceful track record of the United Nations when they have militarily intervened in nations reveals their true nature. the United Nations mission to the Congo, the invasion of Katanga, and the forcing of that stable pro-Western state to rejoin the communist chaos of the Congo, and the atrocities perpetrated against Christian civilians by UN forces, Pakistanis, Moroccans and others, are well documented in The Fearful Master. Now, the word The Fearful Master comes from a quote from General George Washington. He said, "Government is not reason, government is force. Government is a dangerous servant and a fearful master." He said, like a fire in a home needs to be in a fireplace. If that fire gets out of the fireplace, the entire house is in danger of being destroyed. Government is more dangerous than fire. You've got to restrain government. You've got to chain them down with the chains of the Constitution. Keep them in their place and limit them. If government gets out of control, it's more serious than if a fire gets out of the fireplace in your home. And so that was his quote. Government is a dangerous servant, but a fearful master. So G. Edward Griffith looked at the United Nations and said, this is a fearful master. They're accountable to no one. Do you know that UN soldiers cannot be tried for war crimes? They can commit crimes. They can't be tried in their own country or the country where it took place. Rape, murder, you name it. Have you ever come across UN troops being tried for war crimes? And yet they commit them all the time. This character, Kofi Annan, responsible for handcuffing and restraining the Canadian General Romeo Dallaire, who is in charge of the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda during the genocide in 1994. He is documented when Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian General, says, "I shook hands with the devil" in his book. He's not just talking about the Interahamwe, he's talking about Kofi Annan. Kofi Annan would not admit that they'd done anything wrong, even though he didn't give the Canadian General the ammunition they requested, the food they requested, the people were starving. He ordered them to leave and abandon hundreds of thousands of Tutsi Rwandans who had fled to the UN camps for protection. And the UN literally handed over people over to the Interahamwe, who hacked them to death within sight of the UN gates. And next day they came with another list of journalists, pastors, other troublemakers, and the UN went to the trouble of looking through the camp, finding them, bringing them out, and they got hacked to death, and they did this day after day for weeks. And it's been documented, and the general in charge of it documents. Did we know that genocide was coming? Yes. How soon did we know? I informed the General Secretary, January 1994. And Bill Clinton and Warren Christopher, that's the man in charge of the UN, the US and the UN, and all, they all knew about it. Madeleine Not So Bright, the whole bunch of them, they all knew about it. Could we have stopped the genocide? Yes. Should we have done more? Of course. I mean, this is the conclusions to this book. I mean, basically, General Romeo Dallaire says the greatest regret of his life is that he didn't disobey orders, save lives, and spend the rest of his life in prison for disobeying orders. He said, at least I would have had a conscience, a clear conscience. This Kofi Annan, 10 years after genocide, was finally forced to make something of an admission, and his admission to Rwanda was, the world failed you. Not I failed you, not the UN failed you. He was in charge of the UN Security Council. He's the one who personally prevented, as testified by General Romeo Dallaire, prevented them from saving lives in Rwanda. An unarmed hotel manager saved more lives than the UN saved in Rwanda, as the Hotel Rwanda film depicts, which is based on a true event. More people were killed by machetes in 6 weeks in Rwanda than have died from nuclear weapons in all of history. The United Nations forces stood by and failed to save lives. As Holocaust in Rwanda and the British film Shooting Dogs documents, the United Nations actually handed over thousands, tens of thousands, of Christian refugees who had fled to them for protection into the hands of the Interahamwe mass murderers who slaughtered them. The United Nations' involvement in human trafficking has also been well documented and is dramatized in the book and the film Whistleblower, based on policewoman Catherine Volkovac's experience in Bosnia. I'm surprised that a good film was made in this. And in this film, as says, nothing is more dangerous than the truth, Catherine Volkovac, American policewoman, went to Bosnia thinking that she was going to protect women from abuse. I mean, what's a policewoman meant to do? She manages to rescue women who were human trafficked. They came from Moldova, an old Soviet Union, human trafficked and they were being used as sex slaves in Bosnia. She rescues them, puts them in protective custody. The UN hand them back to the very pimps they came from who torture them to death. She takes this to the head of the mission. He doesn't care. She goes to the General Secretary. He doesn't care. They all go after her. She had to flee to England. She's now living in Britain. She's too scared to return to America. She's afraid for life, and the British courts agreed and they've given her political asylum in Britain because she blew the whistle on the UN that the UN's involved in human trafficking. The UN is involved in human trafficking from the highest level, General Secretary and on. And how can it be otherwise? The United Nations is nothing other than the largest collection of unelected dictators and mass murderers on the earth. These people, most of the governments so-called representing the UN, are running human trafficking. Slavery is not even illegal in their countries. These are the Muslim terrorists and so on, and communist dictators. Why would they care? Look here. The dark green. Trafficking is not illegal. It's commonly practiced. Most of the countries in the UN tolerate or practice human trafficking, and slavery is perfectly legal. Why would you think the UN, which is run by a majority of UN members, would care about human trafficking? They're the ones doing it, as she proved. So, the three main pillars of the New World Order that the global elite want to bring about are a one world economy, a one world government, and a one world religion. The shorthand to describe all this is globalism. As the United Nations is working for one world government, so the World Council of Churches is working for one world religion. The World Council of Churches and its local member bodies, like the Southern Council of Churches, promote interfaith conferences and urge us to focus on our shared religious traditions. Like, we've got some shared religious traditions with the Sharia law, flog the head Islamists, and somehow we've got to find some shared religious traditions there. This interfaith movement is being promoted by non-governmental organizations, charity foundations, and prominent politicians worldwide who don't lack for funds. I mean, they have budgets in the hundreds of millions. They can organize many conferences, promote as much as they want. They do not lack for money. The World Council of Churches claims to represent 349 churches, denominations, and church fellowships in more than 110 countries and territories around the world. They claim to represent 560 million Christians, most of whom would be absolutely stunned to hear that this bunch of pagans and their radical liberation theology represents them. I mean, it's not like their churches or democracies would actually even ask their opinions on these things. It's a scam, actually. The World Council of Churches includes most of the world's Orthodox churches, Anglicans, Methodists, Lutherans, Presbyterians, some Baptists, United, and Independent churches. Most, but not all, of the World Council of Churches members tend to be very liberal theologically, which means they don't believe in deity of Christ, inerrancy of Scripture, the Trinity, and so on. Forget believing in hell. Well, maybe hell for racists, but not for them. And they're experiencing dramatic decline in church attendance. Many of the people they claim as members have been converted and have left the World Council Church affiliates to join evangelical churches. So, for example, you take the South African Christian Handbook, and it'll say how many Baptists, that's down to the number, and so on and so forth. When you get to Methodists, about 5 million. When you get to Anglicans, about 2 million. Now, how can they round it up to six digits? Because they don't maintain membership lists, because they can't. And so, according to this, there's vastly more people in the Anglican Church than there are in the Church of England or the Baptist churches. But go to church on Sunday and you find the Baptist and Church of England are full and the Anglicans and Methodists are sparsely attended. Why is this? Because the average Baptist church has twice to three times as many people attending the church as are members, whereas the Anglican Church has 10 times more members than actually attend their church. How does this work? Well, once you've been baptized, your name's on the roll till the roll is called up yonder. You might have been converted, become a Baptist, but apparently my parents got me christened in the Anglican Church, so I'm probably part of the about 2 million Anglicans, even though I never attended their churches ever. That's just the way it works. World Council Church is smoke and mirrors. One high-profile event that epitomizes this move towards a one-world religion is when, in 2011, the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and approximately 50 other church leaders publicly read from the Quran during Sunday morning worship services. This under the theme, Faith Shared, United in Prayer and Understanding. Really. Now, this promotion of interfaith worship is not limited to liberal theologians or the National Council of Churches. Prominent evangelical leaders, Rick Warren, Brian McLaren, Bill Hybels, Robert Shuler, signed a letter to the Islamic community entitled Loving God and Neighbor Together. Recommend you watch Church of Tears exposing these false prophets. This letter claimed Christians consider Allah and the Christian God to be the same. Brian McLaren, a key leader in the emerging church, has actually celebrated Ramadan in his church. Why would you celebrate Ramadan in a Christian church? Roman leader Cicero in 42 BC wrote, "A nation can survive its fools, and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within. An enemy at the gates is less to be feared, for he is known and he carries his banner openly. But the traitor moves among those within the gate freely. His sly whispers rustle through the alleys, heard in the very halls of government itself. For the traitor appears not the traitor. He speaks in accents familiar to his victims. He wears their face and their garments, and he appeals to the baseness that lies deeper than the hearts of all men. He rots the soul of a nation. He works secretly and unknown in the night to undermine the pillars of a city. He infects the body politic so it can no longer resist. A murderer is less to be feared than a traitor." Aldous Huxley in 1932 published in The Brave New World. This book described a future state of human slavery where men live carefree lives in a technologically advanced society, subdued by drugs and bombarded with endless stimulations and distractions. Does this sound familiar to anybody? The 20th century idols of atheism, humanism, and communism have now become mainstream. This, by the way, is the meditation chapel at the UN in New York. Looks like a Baal altar to me. The first attempt to establish a new world order was by the people who came to the land of Shinar and built the Tower of Babel. Others have tried since. Nebuchadnezzar with his Babylonian Empire and the Persians. Alexander the Great with his Greek Macedonian Empire. The Roman Empire. Genghis Khan and the Mongols. The Communist International. George Bush Sr. and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev repeatedly spoke of a new world order in the 1980s. U.S. President Bill Clinton regularly spoke of the New World Order as being the highest priority of the international agenda. And of course, you've got the European Union, the African Union, the Pacific Union, African Union. All of these are part of it. And there's over it, central bank. And of course, they're now trying to have a one world type of currency. In a statement to the United Nations Business Council, September 1994, David Rockefeller, who's sort of like what Oppenheimer was in our country, "We are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis and the nations will accept the New World Order." Henry Ford long ago wrote, "It is well that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there'd be a revolution before tomorrow morning." What is he talking about? We've had Stephen Mitford Goodson here, and we've got his books in our shop, who was the director of the Southern Reserve Bank, and he says, "The South African Reserve Bank is a sham. It's not South African, there's no reserves, and it's not a bank. The Federal Reserve Bank of America is not federal, there's no reserves, and it isn't a bank. It's a scam." Now, the money doesn't exist. When a government comes to borrow money from the Reserve Bank, they create it on the screen, they give them the check, so to speak. The money they've given, that they've loaned, doesn't even exist. It's just created out of nothing. Blip on the screen. But the interest that all we taxpayers pay for the next generation or so for that loan is real. The loan is fake, but the percentage or the interest you pay on it, that's what keeps nations a slave. That's why Stephen Mitford Goodson wrote the book, A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind. And he made the statement here at the Reformation Society when he spoke on it that most of the wars of the 20th century have been bankers' wars to indebt and impoverish nations and keep them enslaved. And he also wrote the book Inside the Southern Reserve Bank. Well, Henry Ford blew the whistle early on. Carol Quigney wrote in his book Tragedy and Hope, which we've got in our library as well, "Their aim is nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system is to be controlled by feudalistic fashion, by central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. Basically, the Sovereign Reserve Bank is a slave of the other reserve banks and all basically under International Monetary Fund, which was founded by a communist, by the way. Major players in working to bring about this new world order include the Trilateral Commission, the Council of Foreign Relations, CFR, which just about every American president for the last 70-odd years has been a member of, except for Ronald Reagan and the present Donald Trump. The others have all been CFR members. And the Bilderbergers. These groups work behind the scenes, but far more prominent tools are the United Nations and the World Council of Churches. And the New World Order has worked hard at destroying those states that attempted to uphold Christian values. Hence, the extraordinary international campaign against Rhodesia and South Africa in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Just to remind you, our parliament and parliament openings used to be something like this. The last real president we had of this country. Don't you miss when grown-ups were in charge? And this country, I mean, just to show you, the standards that were in black schools in Soweto, for example, in South Africa, and our heritage, again, to just remind you of what the cities used to look like, and this is Lanesburg, by the way. Anyone remember Johannesburg Airport when you could drive right up there and get out at the airport, walk onto the runway, go on without being treated like criminal, frisked and stripped? Joburg used to actually look quite nice. Pretoria didn't look bad either. Anyone remember this place? Strand. Strand actually used to have green around it. We used to have cadets at school. We went to march, fight, shoot. Boys grew up by 18 in uniform and making decisions on which lives depended. This in Angola, largest airborne assault in African history, Operation Kasinga. But now people who burned people alive for being town councillors are in charge. And they've got a group around in the West called Antifa, anti-fascists, who are the most vicious terrorists imaginable. Smash the white man march. Well, at least they tell you what they want. The destruction of much of the middle class through financial crises such as those triggered by the World Bank selling worthless derivatives, which caused the 2008 economic collapse. If you haven't seen the film Inside Job, we've got it on the shelf here in the library. Absolutely staggering. Speaking to the bankers and the ministers of finance of different countries, how they cost trillions of dollars and cost tens of millions of people their jobs and their savings and their homes. By the way, this is kind of funny. Downing Street, you know where Downing Street is? That's where the Prime Minister is. Metropolitan Police warning, thieves operate in this area. No jokes. I would say the whole government's a bunch of thieves. Do you remember when bobbies used to walk around with nothing but a truncheon? Now they look like they came out of George Orwell's 1984. And Londinistan has got this Muslim mayor. And today there are 423 new mosques in London, 500 closed churches in London, and 100 Sharia courts in London. Or should we say Londinistan? English people are now a minority in London. Free speech is now a hate crime, and people are going to jail in Britain for opinions and thoughts and conscience issues and things they say. Man arrested for Facebook posts about Syrian refugees. If you're not free to say what you think, you're not free. These are enemies of the people. And by the way, have you noticed it's lamb's wool that they've got around them? When you speak about a wolf in sheep's clothing, although that's really horrible slander on the poor wolves. Your history is being erased, your culture and traditions are under attack, your grandchildren will have no gender, no ethnicity, no nationality. They'll be subjugated worker drones for the overlords if they get their way if present trends continue. You only have to look at the number of people being arrested in Britain for making political comments on social media, which is done to intimidate everyone to silence, to see that Britain has become the absolute opposite of a free country. The first shots fired in the coming civil war with Islam in Europe will probably be aimed at the politicians' heads because there's no one else more to blame than what's going to happen. These are postings you're seeing now on the British internet. The Brits gave up their guns and now the government puts them in jail for Facebook posts. Do you know that Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights and the common law, the dooms of King Alfred, guarantee the rights of all free people in Britain to always keep and bear arms? And the 1689 Bill of Rights expressly says firearms. To think that you don't even now have your freedom of speech or freedom of religion or even of self-defense in Britain. You're not even allowed to have a defense gas spray thing in Britain. A government big enough to give you everything you want is strong enough to take away everything you have. Thomas Jefferson warned that. And so now you've got these unelected European Union dark suit tyranny who take legal action against elected governments for not bowing to their arrogance. And they're not elected. They've got 10,000 bureaucrats in the EU who get more salary than a Prime Minister of Britain, and not one of those 10,000 are elected. And they've got more than a Prime Minister's salaries and remunerations. The EU is one big, ugly, colossal monstrosity of a bureaucracy. And the African Union wants to follow suit. But there's resistance. People are standing up and they're opposing and marching against Islamization of Europe. The Hungarians have mobilized the army and the tanks to the borders to protect their borders. They are serious and Muslims are not going to come into our country. And why would Hungary think like that? Hungary was under the Muslims for centuries. Their capital, Budapest, was ransacked and looted in 1526. 200,000 inhabitants of Hungary were taken off as slaves to Constantinople. They know. The Poles know. You know where the croissant comes from. When the Muslims were besieging Vienna, the heart of Europe, the bakers heard the sounds of tunneling under their shop close to the wall. They alerted the Viennese army. They broke into it, found the Turkish engineers were tunneling under the city. They launched a counteroffensive in the morning. The Polish cavalry arrived also at the same time. The Turks got caught in between, and to celebrate the victory of their rout of the Turks, this was the high point of the Turkish Empire. 11th of September, September 11th, 1683, and the King of Poland in his 70s rode in this victory and charged the Turks and sent them packing. That was the high point of Turkish threat to Europe. And so the bakers made a crescent-shaped pastry called a croissant, in French, actually. The term comes from when Marie Antoinette went to Paris, married the king, or the Dauphin, who's going to become the King of France, King Louis XVI. And so she brought this pastry with her, she brought her own bakers. And in French, it's croissant, crescent. Now, today they're making croissants, I noticed, not in the shape of a crescent. They're more like a tube. You should insist to keep the shape of a crescent. It's to remind us of when the Christians had the Turks for breakfast. If you worship your enemy, you're defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you're enslaved. If you breed with the enemy, you're destroyed. That's what the Spartans said. These are people who fought 300 against hundreds of thousands at Thermopylae to the last man to protect Europe from Asian invasion. Here's another hero. Has anyone heard of Skanderzar? This is Alexander Skanderzar, the hero of Albania. He was the great hero who fought the Muslim Turks, and we're talking about back in the 14th century. And he fought and to liberate Albania from the Ottoman Turks, and brave man, his emblem was the red flag with the double-headed eagle on it, and that's still the flag of Albania today. When I went to Albania, and I was ministering in Albania, I've been on a number of occasions after the communists were overthrown and they became a free country, and their money has got their hero, Skanderbeg, and in their park, his statue dominates. This is the National Museum, and you can see Skanderbeg's statue dominates, and while the area has changed over the years, his flag is still the national flag of Albania. He is a symbol of Christian resistance to Islam. And I don't think there are many people in Europe today who are honoring those who fought the Muslims. today they will rather denigrate the Crusaders and make some myth up about some Muslims who are wonderful. So jihad should encourage us to raise them on crusade. Well, we are needing to get to the solutions, but I think I need to leave that for next week. But let me just say this. One day ISIS will run to the wrong Christians. So, any questions, any comments? I have underestimated the amount of time taking this, so we'll get to the solutions on how to resist the New World Order next week. Questions, comments? Yes.
What can be done about it?
Well, do you want another half an hour lecture? I had planned to get there, but yes. Information, intercession, involvement, resistance, submit to God, resist the devil. He will flee from us. We need to get backbone. Of course, the first thing is understand the tactics of our enemies, understand their weapons, understand our weapons. We've got to, first of all, get informed. But then we've got to get involved and get coordinated and networked. So I'll leave that for next week's focus on solution. However, what I do have is I've got notes on tonight's presentation. How the New World Order is hijacking civilization. Any other questions or comments?
You said age-segregated terms are evolution something?
It's evolutionary, that's correct. Now, even my wife, Lenore, was born the same year as me, 1960, she went to a one-roomed schoolhouse in Schladming, in Großgemein in Austria. So she said from age four, her to put on skis, push out the door, she'd ski down the road to the school, and there was all standards in one classroom. So that wasn't that long ago that you'd have a many ages dealing with a school in the same room. The age segregation to school has come about because of evolutionary teaching that the way how people evolve and so on, you've got to have a totally different education style and approach for every age and so on. And this is where they started to come out with segregating ages of schools. The next thing was Sunday schools. Churches used to all, people used to go to church and all ages, including a babe in arms, were in the service. That was normal. And it's in the lifetime of most of us here that churches have adapted to where the children now leave when the sermon comes on, as though they don't have the brains to understand a sermon, and also encourages the pastor not to incorporate them more. And they go to children's church. This means you start to have this kind of mindless discussion like the children of today are the church of tomorrow. That's nonsense. What makes them not part of the church today? Is the church age restricted that you can't be a member of the church until you reach a certain age? No, the children of Christian families are part of the church today. Why the church of tomorrow? Why not the church of today? And so instead of having Sunday school for all ages and after church or before church, they now have Sunday school at the same time as church, so the children are being babysat for the convenience of the parents. But what you've done is you've age-segregated church. And the funny thing is, instead of keeping the young people in church, it guarantees they leave.
That's right.
Because when they come to the end of teen church, I mean, it's not their church.
No.
They don't feel at all part of it, and they leave. And so, in fact, churches that have adopted age segregation die in a generation. It's a very, very ineffective way of doing it. So there's, in our book, Reforming Our Families, the red book there, we've got a chapter at the back on teen church and so on. This is a book my wife did, and we had 8 different people participating. But looking at this on teenagers and then a critique of the modern youth ministries and then teen church, beneficial or destructive. We look at, and there's different teenagers writing into it too, including my daughter Andrea wrote in there too, at the time while I'm in there. So different perspectives, 8 different people giving contributions, reforming our families. We came to the conclusion that age segregation of churches is catastrophic. But it also grew out of an evolutionary mindset. It was evolutionists and secular humanists who started the age segregation. Because think of it, in life, do we only relate to people our age?
No.
The only time we do is at school. It's not real life. In a home school, a child learns to deal with people older and younger than themselves and relative grandparents normally. In a normal government segregated school, you know, I can't talk to that friend or sibling who's one grade different from me in some cases. That's totally unrealistic. That's ridiculous. Since when nothing in life is age segregated except the schools? It's not preparing you for life at all. But just like people say, dating isn't preparation for marriage. Dating's preparation for divorce. Dating teaches you the mechanics of divorce. It's not really teaching courtship. So there's a lot of things we're doing today which we thought was an improvement on our parents' generation that actually have turned out to be counterproductive.